Yo, have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? When I was trying to get this podcast off the ground, I had a lot of questions. How do I record an episode? How do I get my show onto all the apps that people like to listen to? How do you make money? The answer was pretty simple for me. I started using Anchor. Anchor is a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing your podcast. And best of all, it's 100% free and super easy to use. And now, Anchor can match you with great sponsors who want to advertise in your podcast. So that means you can get paid immediately, like right away. In fact, that's what I'm doing right now by reading you this ad. It's super simple. So if you always wanted to start a podcast, let's start now. Go to anchor.fm/start to join me and the diverse community of producers using Anchor. Again, that's anchor.fm/start. See you soon. Today's episode of the Stretch 4 Pod. Today on the line, we've got Raj coming in from Montreal.
What's up?
My main man Josh coming in from Ottawa.
Coming in hotter than Anthony Davis in a playoff game.
Is that even possible?
Probably not, but I'm going to try.
Come on, man. And there's me coming in from Toronto. My name is Peter, and today we're going to talk about the playoffs. We've gone through half a weekend so far of some hot games, guys, and I think it's best that we start off in New Orleans.
All right, well, I never would have thought that the Pelicans would have been the first team to advance to the second round, but they absolutely just demolished the Blazers. They beat them on the court. The coaching, Gentry outcoached Stotts. It was something that I think none of us really predicted. I don't think any of the NBA analysts really saw that one coming, but they actually just had the perfect game plan. And I almost felt bad for Portland, but you know what? Give New Orleans credit. They had a great game plan. They executed. Jrue Holiday showed up. Anthony Davis is obviously a beast. And Nikola Mirotic.
Yeah, and like every single ESPN writer that chimed in before the series picked Portland in 5, 6, or 7 games. So nobody picked New Orleans, and I think what a lot of people didn't really look at was almost every single one of the, you know, the West teams, 8 through probably 4, maybe even 3, were pretty close together in terms of, you know, talent level and just the way they were playing as the season was ending. It seems like an upset, but in reality, they were only like one loss worse than Portland was this year. And New Orleans just came in with the right game plan, like you said, and they were able to pull it out in 4 games because, honestly, in this series, they had the 2 best players in terms of, you know, the quality of play in the playoffs.
They may have even had like 3 best players because Damian Lillard and McCollum were pretty like MIA for the most part, right? I mean, they came back for like games 3 and 4, but I might actually take Rondo's performance over both of those guys, considering the 4 games that they played. Or, like, even Mirotic.
Yeah. Mirotic,
playoff
too.
Rondo was...
He probably played better than both, than all those guys. Yeah.
Yeah, so at this rate, I think we just said they had, like, the best 4 players in the series, let alone, like, Davis, who's probably in, like, the top 3 players discussion right now, and Jrue Holiday, whose stock has just gone up so much since the playoffs began.
Who do you think was the kind of the big performer for New Orleans? Because I think everyone expected Anthony Davis to have a great series. I think it was like either Jrue Holiday, Rajon Rondo, or Nikola Mirotic that really kind of all of them stepped it up. But who was the most surprising? Like for me, it was Rondo because I think like at times he didn't seem really into the game and like he didn't have a great regular season. But like playoff Rondo is another animal.
Yeah, for me, I would say that it's not just one person. It was just a game plan. I mean, going back to, you know, the coaching battle, I think that Gentry came in with the right game plan. He, you know, trapped the ball every single pick and roll, which Portland just never adjusted to, which is really odd. I mean, they didn't really find a way for them to avoid having Aminu take every single three-point shot or Evan Turner getting the ball in the middle of the floor, which is something that they didn't obviously want. And then the last game, even though McCollum had 38 points, like he was taking some really tough shots and he was making everything. So even though he had a really good game, and Aminu was still very good, he was still 5 for 11 from 3, they didn't really find a way to break New Orleans' defense in the key parts of the game. And then obviously on defense, they really had no chance against that Holiday AD pick and roll, especially in the last game. Those guys had 40-plus points together. They had, I think, 85 points in total, if not more. So they really had no answer for those guys. And then, you know, to New Orleans' credit, they ran that play, like, every single play in the second half, too.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to, like, have a solution to the Holiday AD pick and roll, right? I mean, what are you going to do? With AD rolling towards the rim, you're sort of boned. And Holiday is a pretty good shooter on his own. So, like, that kind of pick and roll is friggin' lethal out there. And, like, realistically, they had, what, Yusuf Nurkic trying to cover AD? He's too slow. He doesn't have the same kind of hops as AD. And Holiday, what, was McCollum covering him most of the time, I assume? So you're kind of boned.
Yeah, it was McCollum and Lillard, and he unlocked his entire game, whether it was, you know, off the dribble, shooting his little mid-range floaters, or just pulling up from three. He had a couple of big threes in the fourth quarter, just pulling up in transition shots he didn't really normally take, because normally he's more of like a mid-range and in type of player. But in the series, he shot the three ball really well. And obviously Rondo, too, running the pick and roll with AD was masterful.
Yeah, and again, like, I'm still shocked by New Orleans and how well they played. And, like, the way they played against Portland, I really think that they're a threat to a lot of other teams in the West, because the formula that they used against Portland, like, that blueprint, I think could be a very effective blueprint against every team in the West. I think, obviously, having Curry and his, like, great shot-making, and also having Houston with, like, their multiple weapons and their perimeter shooting could really kind of beat that blueprint, but I think they're actually going to be a team that's going to be difficult to beat going forward. So, like, credit to Alvin Gentry for putting up a good game plan.
Yeah, and I think that game plan is going against the one team that can easily break it in Golden State, because you're going to have Draymond in the middle of the floor if they decide to do the exact same game plan on KD, just trying to trap the ball. And then you have Iguodala on the wing, who's an extremely smart player who can also make the right plays. So they're going to be playing 4-on-3 a lot against this defense, and AD can't do everything on defense. So I think if that ends up being the matchup, but it's, you know, it's looking like it's going to be, obviously, in the second round, and Curry's not back, I think they're going to have a hard, you know, really tough time against Golden State. But that's for another podcast. We'll talk about that another time.
Were you guys a bit more, like, surprised by New Orleans, or were you more disappointed by Portland? Because, like, in the first two games, I would say I was disappointed in Portland, but looking back on it, I just think New Orleans had, like, the best plan.
I think it was also a result of the matchup, right? I think if Portland had gone up against essentially any other team in the West, they could have put up a much better fight, because no one has such a versatile or lethal attacker as AD, both offensively and defensively, right? I think they just got, like, the shit end of the stick in that sense.
Yeah, and most teams don't really have the type of players, especially with, you know, the big men that New Orleans have, to where they can trap the ball effectively and get back to their man, or in this case, just leave one guy open every play. So I think with Portland, like, if they were to play against even a team like Golden State switches everything, so I think Lillard and McCollum are comfortable against that, playing one-on-one. But this series, they just didn't allow them to get any airspace. And I was mostly disappointed with Lillard this series, because he played at an all-NBA level the entire year. And then come playoff time, he just showed that his game isn't quite to that elite point guard level, like, you know, the greats, like, you know, Stephen Curry, obviously, off the dribble. I think he still has a little bit of way to go to get to that level, especially, you know, finishing off the dribble at the basket and then creating for his teammates. He made the right plays a lot of the time on the pick and roll, but he needed to do more, and he needed to find different ways to score, because when they were trapping the ball, he had to, you know, sort of do what Steph does and, like, play off the ball and run around screens and try to find different ways of getting open besides just running pick and roll every play.
Yo, he's old, eh? He's 28 already.
Yeah, he's in his prime, but he can still get better, I think. He got a lot better this year in terms of his off-the-dribble plays, but not against New Orleans, obviously, in the playoffs.
Yeah, I think Stotts has to do a lot with that, with the team's offense this offseason. Because it's a lot of the same issues that we saw with the Raptors last year, where, you know, the two primary scorers are like the two guards. Once they get trapped, they don't really know what to do, and then it's either a turnover or like a poorly contested like long jumper, essentially.
I think that more so has to do with the talent level, though, because you can't really ask guys like Evan Turner and Aminu to become, you know, secondary ball handlers like you can with, you know, guys like DeLon Wright, Fred VanVleet, even though they made, you know, big jumps this year. They're second-year players, obviously, but or in Wright's case, third-year player. But I just don't think you can rely on those guys to make plays off the dribble. I think Portland's problem isn't management. I don't think it's Terry Stotts' problem. I think that if they fire him, it's going to be a big mistake because he's one of the better coaches in the league.
I don't know, man. I don't think it's... Evan Turner can handle the rock. Like, he's great off the bench.
He is not a good player.
He's not a good, like, scorer, but he can handle the rock and do his stupid little, like, mid-range jumpers or, you know, his paint scoring. He's a big guy. And he can score decently well.
Yeah, but at the same time, he's not going to be a starter because you want those two guards to handle the ball all the time in the starting lineup, right?
Yeah, you don't need him to be a starter, though. The whole point was for him to come off the bench. They just overpaid him.
Yeah, my point is, who's going to start instead, right? Like, Harkless is okay, but he's not a guy you can rely on to, you know, take more than one dribble and, you know, rely on him to do something with it. So I think it's just a lack of talent. I mean, you look at their bench from yesterday. I mean, they had Ed Davis, Zach Collins, Wade Baldwin, and Pat Connaughton off the bench. Like, that's not a lineup you can rely on in the playoffs.
No, but those guys are all still pretty young, too. Connaughton and Collins are both rookies, right? Connaughton might be a second-year player. Baldwin's coming off.
Yeah, I think he's a second or third year player, and he made a jump this year. But I just don't think he's another guy you can rely on, and especially in the playoffs where you need to be able to create plays off the dribble. He's more of a shooter, which is okay in a sense. I mean, he can play like 10, 15 minutes a game and be effective at his role, but he's not a guy you can, you know, put in the starting lineup next year and expect a lot out of him.
Yeah. That's true. I don't know.
Like
they
made their mistake with, you know, signing Harkless and Turner, especially that huge contract, and then Myers Leonard off the bench, who doesn't even play, and he got $40 million. So they tied up their money into players that just are not good.
Yeah, they got to try to offload some of those contracts. I don't know how they can do it, but hopefully they can. It'll be difficult for them this offseason.
Yeah, they're going to have to do what they did with Crabbe and just attach a couple picks.
That's true. You know who has a lot of picks waiting for them is Philly, man.
We should switch over to that.
Yeah, how good is Embiid?
He had his worst game of the season last game, and he was just an absolute monster on defense. He totally changed the game, especially in the second half, with his defensive play, all the block shots, and just, you know, deterring Miami from going to the rim. Dwayne Wade obviously had a really good game, but outside of them, like, he totally quarantined the paint off from any Miami guard from getting in there. And, you know, James Johnson and Winslow just stopped getting the paint besides, you know, they're playing transition. So he was just next level.
Yeah, and it's actually so impressive how he did it with the mask on. And, like, you see when he tried to sneak on to like, one of the plays without his mask, and, like, Brett Brown was like, no, don't try that again. Don't be dumb.
Yeah, I find it comical just because, like, you can see that he just doesn't want to play with a mask, and he wants to be on the court as much as possible. But, like, it's like, you know, your parents are always like, no, you have to wear your helmet, and they won't let you ride your bike without it. So, that's how I see it, and Embiid's, like, trying to do everything he can to avoid that. But back to your question, like, especially since he's been playing in games 3 and 4, like, it's really kind of change the way that Miami has to approach the game offensively, and he is a premier defensive player, and it really does help Philly. Like, I look at their team, and they have, like, the exact recipe to go far in the playoffs. They have great shooters. They have Bellinelli, Saric, Ilyasova, Redick, and then they have a great center in Embiid, who's good defensively, and then they have, like, that player that can kind of mix and do it all. And man, like, that was a very good game. I personally thought that Miami was really going to be able to hold off and tie the series up, but Philly showed a lot of character and came back and were able to close.
Yeah, and, like, honestly, Philadelphia had one of their worst games of the year, too. It wasn't just Embiid. I mean, through three quarters, I think they had 23 turnovers, which in most games, especially against good teams, you're going to be down like 20 points. So it just felt like in the first three quarters they should have been down a lot more than they were. And somehow in the fourth quarter, just like in game three, they were able to really slow down Miami. They totally changed the defensive game plan, too. Like in the first three quarters, they were sort of doing what New Orleans was doing with Portland, in that they were leaving whoever was the power forward on the floor just wide open from three. They're just letting Winslow and James Johnson just shoot. And they were like hesitating a lot of the time just because they didn't really shoot that well in this game, whereas game three, they shot pretty well from the three-point line. And then in the fourth quarter, they started trapping the ball more. So it's just really interesting to see how they, you know, totally changed their entire game plan from the first three quarters to the last quarter. It seems like they're conserving their energy in the first three quarters. And then in the fourth, they just decided to swarm and see if Miami can handle it, which they haven't been able to the last few games.
Yeah, it's crazy to have like one of the youngest teams in the playoffs, at least, to be like conserving their energy for the fourth quarter. It's absolute genius.
It worked too, because they didn't have to play McConnell or, you know, Markel Fultz. They just played Simmons the entire second half.
Really? He played the entire half?
He played the entire half, which, you know, really helped them. It's, like, in the fourth quarter, like, he was amazing, too. He was making every play. I mean, Embiid was awful on offense. He kept turning the ball over against Bam Adebayo a lot of the time.
Yeah.
He kept trying to back down, and Bam wasn't giving any ground. Then he would try to force it up, and then he'd keep falling down and throwing the ball out of bounds. So yeah. Simmons had to take a lot more of the offense.
He's so uncoordinated sometimes when he's posting up. Like it's so easy to forget that he's like 7'2", until like instances like that where you're like, oh yeah, this dude's like huge. No wonder he's just like tipping over and like falling in slow motion.
Yeah, and both guys have serious turnover problems. I mean, they had 15 combined turnovers, but again, in the fourth quarter, they were able to slow the game down a little bit, and Simmons was making the right reads, and obviously Redick made that huge shot in the corner as well, so that was a really well-run play. I mean, Brett Brown doesn't get enough credit for his in-game adjustments and just his overall plays out of timeouts. He's been almost as good as Stevens, I think, out of timeouts this year in terms of creating offense with a bunch of guys who are not that experienced and playing together.
That was a really good play, but I'm going to blame Hassan Whiteside for that one. Not like Redick.
Let's always blame him.
Yo, Whiteside, I watched that play at least four times to figure out why he was so open, and I couldn't figure it out. Whiteside just like did not move out of the paint. It was like the simplest pick and roll, and then he just like stayed there and chilled with Embiid while Redick's man was like moving back at the same time because he was screened. And you're going to leave J.J. Redick, like one of the best shooters in the league, just wide open on the baseline for like an 18-footer? Are you kidding me? How dumb are you of a defender to just like chill there? No wonder he doesn't get like playing time.
Yeah, it was sort of odd how he was in the game in the first place, because most of the time late in games, Spoelstra will take him out and put in either Olynyk or Bam. And Olynyk hasn't really played the last two games just because he can't really match up with Embiid when Embiid's on the floor.
Yep.
And, Bam has been playing pretty well on defense anyway. He hasn't really been scoring, obviously, but defensively he's been really good against Embiid, so it's sort of surprising how he wasn't in the game there where he could have, you know, possibly switched on to J.J. Redick and slowed down that play.
Whiteside did have a lot of offensive rebounds, though. I think that may have been why, just to get their, like, offense flowing a bit. Because in the fourth quarter it was just Dwayne Wade, right? Like, Dragic wasn't really big in the fourth. James Johnson had a couple of like jumpers, and that was basically it. Aside from Dwayne Wade's like crazy fadeaways and his N1 drives.
Yeah, like especially like in the last 5 minutes, you could see that the whole offensive game plan for Miami was really to give the ball to Wade and let him try to isolate their defender, whoever they had on Wade, and really kind of to get a mid-range shot. And like, unfortunately for Miami, those shots didn't fall as often as they did in like the last 15 years, or not 15, last 10 years that he's been playing in Miami. But I think, just back to Josh's point, I have to give a lot of credit to Philadelphia's coaching. Like, they came out in the fourth quarter, and even though Miami was winning the game for like the first three quarters, like they always kind of knew that Philadelphia was like one two or three minute run away from making this a tie game and then taking over. So they kept them close, and they were able to finish the job.
Yeah, I normally don't see young teams have the fortitude to win on the road too, especially in that type of environment. And they've been winning both ways too. They won fast and when they won slow in the series, which is really impressive. It just shows how multi-dimensional and flexible and versatile the Philadelphia lineups can be. The lineup that sort of got them going late in the third quarter didn't even have Simmons or Embiid on the floor. I thought that was where Miami's going to pull away. During those two or three possessions, Ilya Sova got like two wide open threes, and that sort of brought them back in the game when they were down like 9 points. So it's pretty impressive.
Ersan, man, coming up big for them. Actually, like, Bellinelli and Ilya Sova have come out so huge for this team. Right? Like, they were definitely a huge reason why they were able to have that 14-game winning streak into the playoffs. And that, even now, like, for guys that joined just... When was a buyout season? Like, 2 months ago?
Yeah, I think it was in late February, early March.
Yeah. Yeah, it was after the All-Star game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive how much chemistry these guys have with, like, these two guys have with the whole team. You know what I mean? Like, it's impressive, man. It's very surprising, but they've done really well, especially for such a young team. That, do you guys think that they could make the East Finals at this rate?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that Miami would be the toughest road in terms of getting through the first two rounds, because the next series, whether it's Boston or Milwaukee, like, Philadelphia has so many different advantages in both of those series. Against Boston, they obviously have the scoring advantage to where Boston can't really keep up with them, especially if they play with a high pace. And then Milwaukee's just a mess, so I think they would beat them either way.
Yeah, like, I agree. I think they're going to beat Miami, and their advantages over Boston and Milwaukee in terms of depth, the way that they can score, the problems that they can cause to each of their offenses, especially with Boston without Irving. I don't really see Boston being much of a threat. And at the end of the day, the good thing about Philadelphia is their shooters are hot. And if they continue to play like this, I think they are the team to beat in the East right now. Of course, there's other teams of like the Raps, maybe Washington. Who knows who comes out of that series now that it's 2-1. And then there's also the winner of Cleveland, Indiana. But at the end of the day, they're going to make the East Finals. And then from there, it probably comes down to who they end up playing. But like, I would say that they're the funnest team to watch in the East, hands down.
Oh, for sure.
I think they're the funnest team to watch in the NBA.
Okay, hold on. This goes back to your funness category as well. But who's got hotter shooters right now, Philly or Utah?
Philly, easily.
Philly, easy.
Okay, who's funner to watch, Philly or Utah?
Oh, Philly by far.
Philly. Utah is, like, admirable to watch because they play well on both sides of the court, and they kind of grind in a lot of their games. Whereas in Philly's kind of like a bunch of great shooters. They have a few good weapons offensively, and they play hard defense. With Embiid especially kind of protecting being the rim protector. But I would say that they're just they're just fun to watch.
Damn, I thought I would get some Utah love over here, man. Especially from Raj. Aren't you the Donovan Mitchell lover? What happened?
Hey, I still think Donovan Mitchell is, I wouldn't say he's a better player than Ben Simmons, but I think he's more deserving of that Rookie of the Year award. And I think he's going to be a hell of a player going forward. But as a team, Philly is just this is a great year for that city. So who knows? They might make it all the way to the NBA Finals. And I still think the winner's coming out of the West. But you know what? Let's see them make it at least to the next round. And we'll take it from there. But I love watching them play.
I think that both teams are pretty similar in their approaches this year. I think it comes down to their coaching styles, too. Because both Brett Brown and Quinn Snyder have really empowered their role players to just have the green light on offense. Guys like Joe Ingles and even Jarebko off the bench. Exum, when he comes in the game, he just goes and attacks. They don't really have to worry about making mistakes. They just want their guys to be aggressive. And guys like Bellinelli and Ilya Sova, if you put a leash on them to where they can't really play their games on offense, which is essentially them just chucking up a lot of shots, but... when you have guys like Simmons and Embiid, they get open, so you want them taking those shots. But if they take 10 to 15 shots, their teammates are okay with it, whereas in other systems, they may not be. So you see teams like Portland and OKC that just have two or three guys that take all the shots, and the rest of their players take maybe five or shots or less. And then you see the other teams that are more fun to watch, like Utah and Philadelphia, where they really move the ball, and whoever gets a shot gets a shot. They don't really care who shoots it. So I think it really comes down to coaching and, you know, throughout the season, giving those guys the green light. Even a team like Toronto, you know, having Van Vliet and DeLon Wright really break out this year, that was it comes down to coaching in that case. With Dwayne Casey's done a really good job in terms of development of his players. And just giving those guys confidence to play long minutes and, you know, be the guy out there at certain times of the year gives them confidence in the playoffs. Once that comes around, you have the confidence to actually do that against higher level competition. So I think your habits in the regular season often, you know, dictate how you play in the playoffs. And that's why Philadelphia and Utah are doing so well.
Did you call Marco Bellinelli a chucker?
The biggest chucker in the NBA.
Are you sure about this? You mean this guy who's taking, like, leaning threes is a chucker? I don't know, man.
It's so funny, too, how he never takes a spot up. He only takes off-balance threes, even when he's open.
Yeah, it's like he's allergic to spot-ups. It's like they're too easy.
I see him more as like a human slinky. You know, he just can't stay upright. He's always like moving to the side no matter what. It's like he has like an imbalance in his system or something. I don't know.
It's like center of gravity's off. And like it honestly looks like he has like one shot. Like if he was an NBA 2K18, like he would only have fadeaway. Like his fadeaway would be like 100 and every other shot would be zero.
He's allergic to spot ups, man.
Yeah, I feel like if he got pulled over by the police and they asked him to stand on one foot, he'd fall over.
He can't walk in a straight line.
No, hell no, that's not happening. He's going to fall over five times.
He's swerving on the road. All right. Realistically, though, who's been hotter? Ingles or Marco Bellinelli? Because Ingles has been on fire for the past like 3 games, right? Especially this whole Utah team has just been absolute fire for the last 2 games. You know, Rubio has been incredible in Utah. I don't know if he can continue this like crazy shooting streak of his, but this Utah team might be for real.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Ingles is like the anti-Bellinelli in that he really only takes good shots. And that's why he's shooting such a high percentage this year, and that's why he's improved so much. He's such a good decision maker on the ball. I mean, that's why he's been probably one of the better secondary ball handlers in the NBA, just in terms of, you know, if Donovan Mitchell or Rubio doesn't really have anything at the start of the offense, they kick it out to him. He just makes the right decision in running pick and roll with like Gobert and Favors. And he shot over 50% from three in the playoffs this year, even though it seems like Paul George has sort of shut him down besides, you know, game three, obviously. But he shot over 50% because he just takes good shots. He just makes the right decision every time.
Yeah, his basketball IQ is, I think, through the roof. But just going back to Rubio, I don't think we have to worry about it because Russ just said he's going to shut that shit down next game. And he guaranteed it, so I guess we'll all be waiting for game five. But I think, like Josh said, like they take completely different shots. But who's been hotter? I'm going to say Bellinelli's been hotter because, like if you shoot like the way that Bellinelli does, you're either making everything or you're missing everything. And like everything's going in for him. So I'd say he's the hotter shooter right now, but Joe Ingles, I'd say, is the more consistent shooter.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. What do you guys think about this Thunder team? Do you think they can come back? Right now they're down 2-1. And if Russ says he's going to shut that shit down, like, you know, we've all seen what Russ can do when he's really set to something, but does that mean that they'll actually be able to beat this Utah defense? Because every time that OKC goes small, man, Utah stays big, and Favors and Gobert just eat everything inside the paint.
See, when a player says something that outlandish, I always wonder why reporters don't follow up with a question to their insanity, you know? Why couldn't he have done this? Why couldn't he have done this in games 2 and 3? Like, what the hell is he waiting for? Rubio just lit him up both games. So why does he have to wait until game 4 to finally decide to play defense?
He's gotta do it for the fans, man. He's gotta do it for reporters. He's making jobs out there, okay?
He's making careers.
Yeah, if he didn't do this, like, all the beat reporters wouldn't have jobs.
So he's getting his assists in life.
But I think, I think, like, Utah actually prefers if Russ really tries to, you know, shut down Rubio, because if he does that, it's gonna open up another section of their defense is going to be open, because every time they try to trap Rubio on the pick and roll, he found the right player. He had a triple-double last game, obviously, right? So he was finding Ingles in the corner for a bunch of open threes. He found Favors on the roll to the basket a couple plays. So they decided to switch their defense from letting Rubio take those off-balance, weird one-foot shots that he's been making the last couple of games. I think that he's going to be able to find a different seam in the defense and be able to kill them a different way. And plus, Mitchell wasn't really that good last game, so he is another huge factor for Utah going forward, obviously. But I think if they really focus in more on Rubio, like, Mitchell's going to have more touches, and that's, I think, what Utah wants overall.
Yeah, I got to agree. I can't wait to see how much energy Russ expends on, like, shutting that shit down on Rubio, and what that actually means. Like, does that mean he's just going to press up on him every time? Or, like, how long he's going to press up for? Like, I'm assuming he's going to let Rubio get the ball to half court and then, you know, put a little bit of pressure on, push him a couple of times, but say he picks up, like, a quick foul or two. You know what I mean? Or, like, say, like, he presses up and Rubio just blows by him or just feeds the ball outwards. What's going to happen then? Because we've all, like, the way that our offense is set up is that Gobert will easily move forward to get the ball and get Rubio out of the trap. And then what? You're playing 4-on-3? Doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, like, the worst thing you can do against a non-shooter is play up on them, right? Because you want them to shoot long shots. And Rubio hasn't been good from the three-point line. Like, most of his shots last game were either from the paint or from mid-range. So if they pressure up, like, he's the type of smart player to be able to find the seams in the defense.
Yeah, I think also, like, I think Russ is, he's going to take that battle maybe a bit too serious and at the cost of team defense. And
that sounds familiar.
You know what? Well, at the cost of his team, pretty much, no surprise. But at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of, like, problems with OKC, and Utah's just, like, overall, they play better as a unit. I think there's a few teams in this playoffs that, like, I find it, like, almost difficult to watch offensively, and, like, OKC being one of them, Milwaukee being another. Like, it's just not fun watching them offensively because it's just very stagnant.
Yeah, that's what you end up getting with, like, ISO players, right? Russ is a pure ISO player unless he's dishing the ball off or dropping it off for Steven Adams or dishing it out to, like, Paul George for a three. Aside from that, he's pretty much just going to do his own thing. Melo is Melo. He's always going to be Melo. He's just not going to change. And PG still doesn't have a good position in the team's offense. Right? Like, he's still kind of still figuring out what to do. So, inevitably, with the OKC's offense, you're bound to just have one guy pounding the rock for a good, I don't know, 15 seconds out of the shot clock until he decides to do something. It's pretty brutal, man.
Yeah, and the one thing that we talked about before the series started was that Westbrook wasn't going to be able to get the same types of looks in the paint. And he's really shied away from going at Gobert the entire series. But the one thing that we predicted that would happen was he would take a lot more of those mid-range shots. And especially in the fourth quarter, like, he didn't really take a lot of shots. And he's been sort of deferring to Paul George in the fourth quarter. And George has been on and off. But Westbrook just hasn't been himself the last two games, especially on offense. He hasn't really push the pace. I think that's the biggest thing with OKC. Like, they need to push the pace against Utah in order to have a chance, because when you get them in a half-court game, it's going to be really difficult to score when Gobert's on the floor especially.
Yeah, but to push the pace, you have to get defensive stops usually, right? Like, it's hard to push the pace against the teams that are actually hitting their shots. And especially the way that Utah plays is that they're really good in the half-court defense, but their transition D is pretty underrated as well. Like, they have, all their bigs are able to run back pretty quickly. And they don't really, like, chase offensive boards aside from, like, one of their bigs. So for transition points to work for OKC, it's kind of difficult to do anything unless they actually get that stop and go kind of thing. So I think...
Yeah, but I think that comes... I think it goes back to the elephant in the room, though. It's Carmelo. Because when he's on the floor, Utah bases their entire offense to try to get him in switches or try to get him to defend the primary ball handler and, you know, pick and roll play. So I think if he's off the floor more and Grant plays more, I think that OKC has a better chance in the series, but I'm not sure that they're going to go away from that at this point because Carmelo's, you know, ego is way too fragile.
Even with Grant on the floor, though, they weren't playing that well, man.
Like, they weren't, but they played differently, though. They were like, they were pressuring up more, and they had better defensive play, I think. And he's like one of the only guys that's been consistently going at Gobert, too. So I think that's a factor as well. He's been able to get a couple fouls on Gobert the first couple games in the series, whereas Melo just keeps taking his pull-up shots. But I think defensively, though, if you want to play at a faster pace, I think Grant's a better option at the four or even at the five when Adams is out.
At the five for sure, because they have no one else, right? The only other option you have at the big is like Patrick Patterson, who went like 3-for-3 yesterday and will never shoot 3-for-3 in his career ever again. Because otherwise...
Yeah, he's a shell of his former self.
Dude, he got paid off of like one half of a season. I can't believe that he got so much praise after that. Like, after that initial Sacramento trade to Toronto. Like, people just loved the way this guy played, but he's not that good.
Yeah, when he played in Toronto, he had his half season where he was hot. He fit the system well. Seems like a really nice guy, well-spoken, and at the end of the day, like, if you can show that you're a good player, like, some team's going to be desperate enough to want to sign you and want your assets. But, like, Patrick Patterson should be, like, a team's, like, ninth option.
Yeah, and he's, like, the definition now of a floor spacer who can't shoot, which is a very interesting role for a player that's playing in the playoffs.
Sounds
like... Who would you rather have? OKC. Would you rather have Tony Snell or Patrick Patterson?
Oh,
real question.
Oh.
I know. It hurts.
Tony Snell really is awful.
But
so is Patterson, They play the exact same role.
They're both floor spacers.
You can't really shoot. Oh yeah, they're the exact same player, except Patterson's like 2 inches taller.
You know what? I'm going to say Patterson because he at least passes the ball. You know what I mean? Tony Snell has that, like, I'm a gunner syndrome, but he's not actually a gunner because he's gunning with water guns out there. He's got nothing. But at least Patterson, like, knows his role, knows that he's, like, a subpar shooter and will only shoot when he's wide open. He won't overhandle the rock like Snell does. You know what I mean? He won't try to go hero ball like Snell does. Snell's friggin' brutal, man. I hate watching that guy play.
Yeah, like, as soon as he gets the ball, and especially, well, as soon as he gets the ball, it's pretty much like he feels like he has to shoot. And that usually means that someone is hoping to get an offensive rebound because the ball's not really going into the...
Yeah, because he knows he's not going to get another shot. He's going to get pulled. So he's got to take every opportunity he has to shoot before he gets, like, sat on the bench again. Hence why the Bucks starting lineup doesn't play for very long.
What was it, like 12 minutes or something?
Something after game like that. Three,
yeah.
Garbage.
Yeah.
Speaking of players who can't shoot, let's go over to the Houston Rockets-Minnesota series, where most of Houston's shooters, especially around James Harden, Chris Paul, just have not been able to get the job done. And going back to the regular season, Coach Mike D'Antoni has said it's due to all the rest that they were giving most of their players coming down the stretch. They haven't really been able to develop a rhythm, especially in the playoffs, with these guys playing the same type of style as they were in the regular season. They're playing a lot slower pace. In the last 2 months of the season, they were playing at the 29th ranked pace in the NBA, whereas the rest of the year, they're playing at around, you know, the 15th ranked pace in the NBA. And it makes a huge difference, especially in the playoffs, where most of their plays now, they're just going isolation with Harden and Paul. And Harden's been on and off the series, which is why, you know, they lost the last game.
I blame Chris Paul.
I also would point the finger at Paul.
Please explain.
I didn't think that would work. I'm only blaming Chris Paul on the pace because he likes to slow it down and be in control. But they're both ISO players. Chris Paul is an assist whore, but he's sort of the same as Westbrook, man. He doesn't make like the right pass. He makes the pass to get himself an assist. And Harden is just that ISO player that he's always been. So it makes sense that this team's out of rhythm because this whole year they've been an ISO team. They only started, I'd say up until the All-Star break, they were pushing the ball fast, they were taking quick threes, everyone was touching the ball. But after that, like, this team really slowed down and went ISO, and I can see why the rhythm is off. They don't dish the ball that much.
Well, I think it also comes down to how Minnesota's playing them too, especially in the half court. because they're still playing the two-on-two matchup where they're having Cat defend everything at the rim, and they're not really helping off the shooters, which is, again, why Houston, I think, has to pick up the pace and shoot quicker threes early in the shot clock, because right now most of their play, they keep trying to get the switch on the Cat, which hasn't been effective so far. And even though Cat's not a great defensive player at the rim, they haven't been able to really get there without their guy being attached to them. Like, Jimmy Butler's actually done a pretty good job the last game and a half. Even though they obviously blew them out in game two, I think he still did a pretty good job on Harden in that game. He went like 2 for 16 in that game, I think.
Yep.
So I think that if they keep playing that type of style, like if Houston continues to play at a really, really, really slow pace, unless Eric Gordon or Anderson come off the bench and they hit a bunch of shots, they're going to be in a really close game, especially in game four.
Even Anderson, though, like he's just coming back from injury, isn't he?
So he is, but he played a decent amount of minutes last game, and he's been an absolute, he's been a Minnesota killer the entire year, in the last couple years, actually. He actually played pretty well. He went 4 for 6 from three, so he was one of the only guys that really got it going. But Gordon especially has been chucking up, like, a lot of really bad shots early in the shot, like, late in the shot clock, sorry. And Green, you know, he's on and off, but he's not a guy that you can really put on the floor for more than, like, 10 or 15 minutes a game before he gets absolutely torched, which is what happened last game.
Green was minus 18 in the game, and like he was what on the court for like 20 minutes or so.
Yeah, that sounds.
Yeah, right. Like
I think Houston's really kind of been out of funk. Like even game one, which they were able to squeak through. Like we all expected them really to for this to be a sweep, and if anything, it would have been a gentleman's sweep. I'd give a bit of credit to Minnesota. I don't think they've done anything like spectacular on Houston. I just think Houston's not hitting their shots, and again. And I think it has to do with the pace. Like, I feel like Houston's going a lot deeper into the shot clock than they normally do. And that really goes down to your primary ball handlers. So that has to be Harden and Chris Paul. And at the end of the day, it's kind of falling into Mini's hands or Mini's favor. And, like, if things don't change, I still think the Rockets are going to win. But it's going to be closer than it needs to be.
Yeah, I think we just established that Eric Gordon is the poor man's Marco Bellinelli.
Especially in the playoffs. That guy has not shown up in the playoffs for a long time now. Even though he had some great regular seasons, he just has not been good off the bench in the playoffs especially. He's playing 30 minutes a game, too, so he has to be that type of secondary ball handler to where he can get to the basket, too, and he's been chucking up shots.
How was he last
shoots,
year?
Like, over 10 threes a game.
How was he What's last that? Year? Do you remember?
I don't really remember, to be honest. I think that he didn't have a great postseason, but I think he was better than what he's doing right now because he just keeps jacking up really contested shots. Like, in the regular season, those were going in, especially those, like, 30-foot shots to give Houston more spacing on the perimeter, like the shots that him and Anderson have been taking. But I don't know. This series, he's just been off. He doesn't look right. And as you said, with the pace, like, Minnesota's playing at a much higher pace, which has allowed guys like even Derrick Rose to reinvent himself, it seems like. And the last two games, he's been really good in transition and being an off-ball cutter. His off-ball cutting sort of reminds me of, like, Dwayne Wade in his prime, which is crazy to say, you know, since Derrick Rose has been, like, you know, he used to be one of the best, you know, primary ball handlers in the league, but now, like, he's getting all of his points off cuts, which is really weird to watch.
Derrick Rose, the young Wade. Oh, my God.
I'm talking about cuts only, man. Oh, man. Cuts only.
Holy. Yeah, Derrick Rose has found himself. It's the Tibbs effect, man.
Yeah, it's a coach that has confidence in you and lets you play the way, any way you want, really.
No, like, it's not any way you want. It's letting Derrick Rose play how he wants Derrick Rose to play circa 2011.
Like he probably just shows some highlights of 2011. He's like, I want you to play like this.
Yeah, yo, remember when you had bounce and both of your knees? I want you to play like that. Like that, I swear that's all the coaching is for Rose. And Rose isn't the guy to turn down shots either, right? He's as big of a chucker as anyone else is in the playoffs, so he's obviously just going out there looking to get buckets.
Yeah, he is, and he's been able to do that the last two games. He shot a really high percentage from the field, and again, he's been able to get into those little crevices when guys like Butler and Towns get into trouble. He just keeps finding those areas like between 12 and 15 feet and just catching and finishing instead of being a guy who just over-dribbles the ball, which is what he was doing in the regular season, which I thought he was going to eventually get cut, but he was able to stay on the team, and now he's making a big impact, which is probably the biggest surprise of the playoffs, I think.
It's okay, weird. I got a question for you guys. Sorry, Peter, to cut you off. But how many fast break points do you think Houston had last night?
I'm going to say under 10, so I'm going to say 6.
How many points did they score? 105? I'll say like 10 to 12.
They had 2 fast break points.
Oh my god, seriously?
There we go.
6 points off of turnovers, albeit Minnesota only turned the ball over 7 times in the entire game.
Well, Houston's supposed to have a good defense, though.
Yeah.
What the hell? They, that's crazy.
2 fast break points.
Who was the lucky recipient of the 2? That's what I want.
I just have the box score, but that stat just jumps out at me. Like you got to pick up the pace. Like, your team's supposed to be kind of run and gun. Like, you have the best shooters in the league from 3 by far, and like you're really not pushing the pace. So,
yeah, that's really disappointing. But to be fair, like, they have what? Chris Paul, Harden, Ariza, Gordon, and Anderson? Those are their 5 shooters, right? At that rate, you have Ariza, who's still a good defender, but not what he used to be. You have Anderson, who can't really play defense on anybody. And Harden, well, we all know that he's like a decent defender now at most, right? So I kind of understand how Minnesota is able to push the pace against this team, because their defense isn't really that good with this kind of lineup, at least. If you want like all the shooters out, you're going to have to sacrifice your defense.
Yeah, I think at the same time, like I was saying before, I think that they do miss Mbamute a lot this series. I think that he's the type of guy that could be playing like 25 to 30 minutes a game, especially going against like Jimmy Butler in the series. And with Houston's switch-happy style, they implemented that system because they wanted to be able to match up with Golden State down the road, to be able to switch everything and have, you know, Tucker and Mbamute switch on to Curry and Durant in pick-and-roll situations. And against a team like Minnesota, when you don't have a guy like Mbamute, you can't really force a lot of turnovers on the perimeter, forcing those guys into help. And like you said, with Green and Anderson on the floor at the same time, it's really hard for them to, you know, really attack the ball handler and, you know, eventually get, you know, a lot of deflections, tip balls, and transition points, because Minnesota only had 7 turnovers the entire game, which really is a testament to that, you know, Houston wasn't able to do what they wanted to do on defense.
So how long do you guys think the series is going to go now? Now that we've bashed on Houston for a good, like, 10 minutes.
5
games.
So at the end of the day,
I think they're just
going to
win game 4. Yeah, but I think at the end of the day also, like, Houston's probably going to end up winning game 4, and then I don't think Minnie's really going to have that much to offer in game 5 on the road against a Houston team that probably wants to close out the series, and that's going to be out. That's going to be it. Like, I can't imagine another scenario, but then again, I never imagined New Orleans sweeping the Blazers, so what do I know?
That's yeah, funny. I mean, Houston has 2 of the best guards in the NBA still, so they're going to be able to figure out a game plan to speed the pace of the game up. And even though D'Antoni's not really the type of coach you really trust in the playoffs to make adjustments, I don't really think he's going to have to with those 2 guys, because they are 2 of the best players in the series, and I think that they're going to be able to adjust and get their guys going, especially in the first half of the game tomorrow.
I don't know, man. Chris Paul? Playoff Chris? Do we really think he's one of the best guards?
Let's not go into this again. Just look at his stats, all right? 21-10, average for the playoffs, high percentages. You don't have to get into this.
I don't know, man. I don't know.
Just because he had a couple mistakes in the OKC series doesn't mean that his entire playoff career has been, you know, a colossal failure, which it hasn't. Harden's, on the other hand, he's had a lot of different series where he hasn't shown up. Chris Paul has been very consistent in the series that he's played.
Yeah, except for game 1 where he had, like, what was it, 6 turnovers?
But they still won.
Doesn't mean he played well, though. You know what I mean?
Well, Harden didn't play 1 game 2 either. Harden hasn't played well the entire series besides game 1, obviously, so Harden's he's got to step it up in game 4.
Harden's not the one on trial. Come on now.
Objection. Leading the witness.
You know what? I realized that my DeMar DeRozan is Peter's Chris Paul.
No, I don't hate Chris Paul that much.
Well, I don't hate DeMar DeRozan.
Oh, no. Come on. Come on.
We'll save that for next episode. We'll save it for next episode.
No. Let's get into this Raptors talk now, man.
Before we get into it, I just want to say that I wasn't on the pod last time, mainly because DeMar DeRozan actually showed up for game two, and like I had a minor heart attack. I couldn't believe what I saw. I thought I was delirious. So I had to take the night off. But yeah, if you want to get into it, I would love to. Raps game four in Washington. What do you want to talk about, Peter?
Oh, man. This game was absolutely brutal to watch.
Wait. Hold on. We're actually talking about this?
Yeah, why not?
I thought we said we weren't.
I just need to rant, man. I just got to get this out.
All right, go ahead. So restart the segment then. Sorry. Go ahead. Do it.
Yeah. No. We're just going to go right. I'm going to keep all of this in, man. Why not? Right. I was furiously texting multiple group chats the whole time. I've talked to people on the phone about this, but Dwayne Casey made zero in-game adjustments down the stretch.
Oh, no, his adjustments were he decided to play Poeltl in the fourth quarter.
No, an adjustment is not staying status quo. An adjustment is to change something, and he didn't change any of his system. He kept the same guys out. DeLon Wright had two layups on like transition points, and then he had two open shots in the half-court sets that they were running. Like, two open threes, and he passed them up. He took, like, two, like, hesitation dribbles inside and then just dumped it off to Lowry somewhere. You know what I mean? Poeltl could not grab a rebound, did not, played barely any defense against Gortat. And then every time that Gortat and Wall ran a pick and roll, both defenders would just stick to Gortat and not actually stay on Wall. So at that point, you have John Wall, who's, you know, one of the best point guards in the league, taking like an open 17 or 18 footer without any kind of contest whatsoever. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, and it sort of went back to what's plagued the Raptors in the last 3 years, to where I sent you guys that screenshot as to what happened in the last 5 minutes of the game in terms of usage rate. And DeRozan took 10 shots, I believe, in the last 5 minutes of the game, and he had two free throws as well. And it just goes to show you, like, in watching that game, I watched the fourth quarter of the game, and DeRozan was basically isolating every single play. And Bradley Beal fouled out with 5 minutes left in the game, and yet this Toronto's team, the first seed in the East, can't beat a Washington team without Bradley Beal, who scored 31 points in the game. And it's really embarrassing.
Yeah, like I saw when Bradley Beal got fouled out in what? I think 3.5 minutes left in the fourth. I thought five. That.
Yeah, it was like closer to four or five.
Okay, well, four or five. Whatever. But like I thought at that moment, like Beal was actually having a very good game. Like he's played well in game three and he played well in game four as well. I thought that Toronto would really be able to kind of like stop Washington, considering their real big threat would have been Wall off the dribble. And if anything, Toronto played worse with Beal off the court, not particularly because thing like they changed anything, but it's just like Toronto choked. And I think what Josh, you were talking about a segment in the game where DeMar DeRozan took like 8 of the Raptors 10 shots and most of them were misses. And again, if I want to go to this again, DeMar DeRozan didn't have a terrible game, but I don't think he did what was necessary to help his team win.
No. He did what he had to do, because that team was not scoring any other way.
No, but the problem is, like, Washington knows exactly what was coming. Like, I saw the last 5 minutes of the game, too, and, you know, with Lowry, when he was handling the ball, they switched Marsh and Gortat onto him 3 times, and they just allowed Lowry to try to take him off the dribble. One time he took a step back 3, and the other 2 times he went to the basket, and they just swarmed him. And they didn't have the guys on the floor that were making shots. They didn't really have anybody who was making shots on the floor, really. And at that point, they just kept going ISO with him and DeRozan, and both guys isolated and fell into that trap, and Toronto's team didn't move the ball, and they had about, I think, 3 turnovers in the last 5 minutes, too, and Wall just ran them out of the building. Wall was just in transition. He's just unbelievable, obviously. He just took over the game.
Well, when you have an offensive powerhouse like Jakob Poeltl on the floor, you really need to utilize that kind of player.
Yeah, and again, like going back to the Raptors of the past few years, like if you're going to play big with Ibaka and a center on the floor, why not put your best center in the game? Like JV's had a really good series so far, even though he only played 15 minutes today. It's just like I don't understand why he doesn't get more minutes, especially when you need rebounds and you need a guy that can, you know, somewhat protect the paint, because Poeltl wasn't protecting the paint at all.
Yeah, and the thing is, sorry, Peter, again, but, like, the thing that really frustrates me is this is kind of the repeat situation of what happened with JV and Biombo, like, 2 years ago, where just Biombo was the more athletic center, and Casey seems to be in love with that, even though, overall, as a basketball player, JV is infinitely better than Jakob Poeltl, and, like it's just frustrating to see this happen again. And JV's effective. Like, he doesn't play as, like, 30 minutes or 40 minutes in a game, but he's still effective when he's on the court, and it's just frustrating to watch. As soon as the fourth quarter comes around, the Raps kind of immediately exclude him from playing.
I don't think he played in the fourth. He barely played in the third, right? Like, I understand wanting athleticism out there because Washington's a pretty athletic team. Put out Pascal Siakam, who was actually having a pretty decent game. You know what I mean? Like,
I don't know, man, because even when you put him out on the floor, he's not really a threat on offense. So
he's more a threat than Poeltl is, though.
I guess, but they play the same type of role on offense, right? They're more of like a, you know, catch on the go and try to finish type of play. But in the fourth...
fine, man.
Yeah, it's fine, but like in the fourth quarter, you need guys to be able to finish plays. I'm not really sure you can rely on him to finish big plays down the stretch, especially in situations where he has to like take a dribble or two and try to, you know, finish over somebody. Whereas like JV has shown consistently, like he can finish over guys, especially when they have small guys on them. So I think if you had JV on the floor when, you know, DeRozan or Lowry are isolating, I think Washington would think twice about switching a guy like Gortat onto Lowry, because they'd have JV being guarded by John Wall or like Oubre. Or he could get an offensive rebound or get a dump-off pass, right? Whereas Poeltl's not really reliable as a guy, or even, you know, Siakam to catch and finish.
Yeah, I think Siakam would have been better on the defensive end in this case. Just because he's more versatile.
Yeah, because you could have switched him onto Wall, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. In any case, we all agreed that Poeltl should be the third option out of these three guys to be on the floor.
Or just play Ibaka at center. Like, why not just go to him at center? I don't get that either. Just if you're going to play with Ibaka on the floor and then Washington only has one big out there, just play Ibaka at center.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I want. I wanted Ibaka at the five and then Siakam at the four. I think that's, like, their best lineup going down the stretch at this point, at least. But no, we got Jakob Poeltl out there instead, who I don't think grabbed a rebound going down the stretch. Or if he did, they were just like garbage rebounds.
Yeah, it's amazing how when you're getting killed on the offensive glass, you just don't put your best rebound in the game. Casey's been like this in the playoffs consistently. He just does not make good in-game adjustments. You know, as good as he was in the regular season and developing the guys and giving them confidence to play like a higher role, like the guards off the bench, and even CJ Miles coming down the stretch. He's played really well in the playoffs, except for this game, obviously. But I don't know. It just... the bench unit hasn't worked without Fred VanVleet, which is also another fact we haven't talked about yet, so hopefully he's back for Game 5.
So here's my hot take. Dwayne Casey is actually the Raptors' biggest choker in the playoffs.
Well, him and DeRozan,
not DeRozan. Not DeRozan. I'm saying Dwayne Casey alone is the biggest choker.
He definitely has a big part to play in the Raps' struggles in the postseason. Like, a huge part.
Yeah. Because DeMar started the game off like 1-for-8, and then the second and third quarter, like, dude was actually on fire. He had like 14 or 15 points in the third quarter alone. And offensively, it was probably the only reason this team actually stuck around. So, as much as I've hated on DeMar in the past, not so much on this pod, because I think this year he's taken that extra step. But over his past years, like, he's improved in every facet that I've wanted him to improve in. Dwayne Casey has remained stagnant over the past years. Granted, like, the system did change this year during the season, but his rotations tonight were just absolutely awful.
Do we think the Raptors are in trouble?
No, I still think they close. Yeah, you're a pessimistic Raps fan, man.
I still expect them to win the series, but, you know, going into Game 5, like, how could you be confident after what just happened?
I wouldn't say confident.
I'm
going to
say it. Like, I said Washington in 7.
I think I think you want them to feel desperate, like sort of like Game 1 was. You know what I mean? Where they're a little bit hungrier. Maybe Casey actually makes the right, you know, personnel moves on the floor.
But he hasn't done that. So how can you think that he's going to do that in the most, you know, the biggest game of the season?
Well, in game
one. Like, who's he going to trust?
Game one, he did it well. Granted, Wright actually showed up for game one. I think the issue with the Raptors is that because you rely so much on the young guys, that when they're on the road, they kind of get, like, hesitant, right? And we saw it tonight. But in Toronto, like, Wright was killing it. And so was Miles.
Yeah, like, this series might just be one of those series, just like the Boston-Milwaukee series, where both teams just can't play on the road. Both teams are just, they're just soft, to be honest, when they get in the road, because they just, they're not capable of hitting those really tough shots and, you know, really key moments. In despite of, like, the, you know, the crowd atmosphere and, you know, being down 7 or 8 points, being able to hit that shot to get it back to, you know, 5 or 4. It just, they don't really have those guys with, you know, a killer instinct that can hit that big shot on the road.
Yeah, but can you guys imagine this scenario coming through? The Raps win game 5. They go back to Washington. And then, again, very similar game to game 4. Where they're going to be in a close game. Washington's probably going to be very desperate. Washington's going to play better at home. They're going to win game 6. Then the Raptors are in a game 7 at home. A lot of pressure. Washington's the 8 seed, the team that really isn't supposed to be in a game 7. And then Toronto has to play with all this actual pressure of a game 7. Like, I could see Washington, like, squeezing this through.
Yeah, plus Washington has the best player in the series, too. That's not even a question at this point.
I don't know. The Raptors do pretty well in Game 7s, man.
Yeah, but Game 7s come down to who the top performers are on each team, right? So I think I would trust John Wall in a Game 7 over, you know, DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry, especially how he's played the last 2 games. He's had, like, 20-plus points and 14-plus assists in both games. He's just been shredding Toronto.
Yeah, but that means he has to continue to do it on the road, too. And Wall has shown in the past that, like, the longer the playoffs go on, the more he's fatigued and slows down a lot. I think Toronto's hoping that that'll be the case in if it comes to a Game 7 as well.
Yeah, true. And like I said before, like, the role players are obviously going to play a huge factor because neither team's role players have shown up on the other team's court. So even though John Wall's been probably really good in every single game so far, he's had his down moments in Games 1 and 2. But overall, like, the second half especially, he turned it on in both games in Toronto. So, I mean, I would trust him more than the other guys, but I think Toronto has more guys, especially off the bench, if Van Vliet comes back to where they should still win the series. And, you know, Van Vliet's injury was supposed to be like a 2-week injury, and the 2 weeks is coming up as of Wednesday. So, again, if he is back, he has a whole other layer to their offense, and I think he'll be the fifth guy if DeLon Wright is struggling.
Yeah, I guess so. I think we should just bring up Stackhouse from the 905.
He wouldn't be a bad... Bad upgrade, I would say.
Dude, at this point, I think we should do what they did in Eddie and just, like, pick a fan out from the nosebleeds.
Well, like, if he doesn't do anything, he's doing what Dwayne Casey does, so...
Exactly. Just pick out random, like, a set of five random players from the stat sheet and put them on the floor.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, did you want him to coach or you want him to play? Or a little bit of both?
No, Eddie did not play. Eddie coached.
Okay.
Eddie won the hearts of the people and then coached. And if there's anything that Toronto fans love, it's a new story.
I would enjoy seeing the greatest free throw routine on display again, though, if he was able to come back and play.
Yeah.
He got so low to the ground when he took his free throws, man. I'm not even sure he didn't fall.
Dude, Stack squatted on his free throws more than I squat at the gym.
I don't know how he does it, man.
His ass was like...
You gotta put your legs in it.
Dude, his ass was on the floor when he shot
those. Yeah, like, how did he get up like that? I'm surprised he never fell once in his career.
Yeah, like, imagine doing that now. Like, Raj, like, this dude was about an inch off the floor, realistically. It was insane.
But it worked, man, and everyone has their thing. Like, at the end of the day, we remember it because it was so unique.
It's true. He's going to be a player that we go back in the vault for very soon.
So, is this series going to 7 games? Can we all agree on that?
As pessimistic as I am, because I think that Toronto, like Peter said, has taken another step in their development this year, I think that they're going to close it out in 6. I don't know why I think this, but I don't know.
No way.
They haven't shown any, like, signs as to them winning actually, you know, a big game on the road, but if they have taken the next step, they should be able to close this out in 6 and prove that they are a 1 seed.
You are a real Raptors fan. My God.
I'm trying to remain optimistic here, okay? I'm talking myself into this.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't see that happening. I think it goes to seven, and then Toronto wins by, like, eight in Toronto in game seven. Toronto is,
it's not six?
No, Toronto is 8-31 on the road in their playoff history. So I'm gonna say this goes to game seven for sure. All right, I think that's about all the time we have for tonight. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. Please remember to rate and subscribe the pod. You know, subscribe to us. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and all the other major podcast networks. And until next time, we'll talk to you soon.
Ciao.
Peace.